another friend, Robert Huntington, was moved of the Lord to go into Carlisle Steeplehouse with a white sheet about him, amongst the great Presbyterians and Independents there, to show them that the surplus was coming up again. And he put an halter about his neck to show them that an halter was coming upon them, which was fulfilled upon some of our persecutors not long after. Another, Richard Sale, living near Westchester, being constable of the place where he lived, had sent to him with a pass a friend whom those wicked professors had taken up for a vagabond, because he traveled up and down in the work of the ministry. This constable, being convinced by the friend thus brought to him, gave him his pass and liberty, and was afterwards himself cast into prison. After this, on a lecture day, Richard Sale was moved to go to the Steeplehouse in the time of their worship, and to carry those persecuting priests and people a lantern and candle as a figure of their darkness. But they cruelly abused him, and like dark professors, as they were put him into their prison called Little Ease, and so squeezed his body therein that not long after he died. Footnote 167. These friends, in their use of signs and striking symbolisms, were undoubtedly following in the steps of the Hebrew prophets. Both William Simpson and Die Hard Sale revere squeezed in Little Ease. The latter, being very stout, came to his death as a result. Little Ease was a hole hewed out of a rock, the breadth across 17 inches, from the back to the inside of the great door at the top, 7 inches, at the shoulders, 8 inches, at the breast, 9.5 inches, from the top to the bottom, 1.5 yards, with a device to lessen the height for purposes of torture. Although those friends that had been imprisoned on the rising of the Fifth Monarchy were set at liberty, meetings were much disturbed and great sufferings friends underwent. For besides what was done by officers and soldiers, many wild fellows and rude people often came in. One time when I was at Pall Mall, there came an ambassador with a company of Irishmen and rude fellows. The meeting was over before they came, and I was gone into a chamber where I heard one of them say that he would kill all the Quakers. I went down to him and was moved in the power of the Lord to speak to him. I told him, "The law said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But thou threatenest to kill all the Quakers, though they have done thee no hurt. But," said I, "here is gospel for thee. Here is my hair, here is my cheek, and here is my shoulder," turning it to him. This so overcame him that he and his companions stood as men amazed, and said that if that was our principle, and if we were as we said, they never saw the like in their lives. I told them that what I was in words, I also was in my life. Then the ambassador who stood without came in, for he said that this Irish colonel was a desperate man, that he durst not come in with him for fear he should do us more mischief. But truth came over the Irish colonel, and he carried himself lovingly towards us, as also did the ambassador, for the Lord's power was over them all. At Mile End, friends were kept out of their meeting place by soldiers, but they stood nobly in the truth, valiant for the Lord's name, and at last the truth gave them dominion. About this time we had an account that John Love, a friend, that was moved to go and bear testimony against the idolatry of the papists, was dead in prison at Rome. It was suspected he was privately put to death. Also before this time we received account from New England that the government there had made a law to banish the Quakers out of their colonies upon pain of death in case they returned, that several of our friends, having been so banished and returning, were thereupon taken and actually hanged, and that divers more were in prison, in danger of the like sentence being executed upon them. When those who were put to death, I was in prison at Lancaster, and had a perfect sense of their sufferings, as though it had been myself, and as though the halter had been put about my own neck, though we had not at that time heard of it. Footnote 168. We have already seen how frequently George Fox had what nowadays are called telepathic experiences. As soon as we heard of it, Edward Burrow went to the king and told him that there was a vein of incessant blood opened in his domains, which, if it were not stopped, would overrun us. To this the king replied, "But I will stop that vein," Edward Burrow said. "Then do it speedily, for we know not how many may soon be put to death." The king answered, "As speedily as ye will." "Call," said he to some present, "the secretary, and I will do it presently." The secretary being called, a mandamus was forthwith granted. A day or two after, Edward Burrow, going again to the king to desire the matter might be expedited, the king said he had no occasion at present to send a ship thither, but if we would send one, we might do it as soon as we would. Edward then asked the king if it would please him to grant his deputation to one called a Quaker to carry the mandamus to New England. He said, "Yes, to whom ye will." Whereupon Edward Burrow named Samuel Shattuck, who, being an inhabitant of New England, was banished by their law to be hanged if he came again, and to him the deputation was granted. Then he sent for Ralph Goldsmith, an honest friend who was master of a good ship, and agreed with him for £300, goods or no goods, to sail in 10 days. He forthwith prepared to set sail, and with a prosperous gale, in about 6 weeks' time, arrived before the town of Boston in New England upon a first day morning. With him went many passengers, both of New and Old England, friends whom the Lord moved to go to bear their testimony against those bloody persecutors who had exceeded all the world in that age in their bloody persecutions. The townsmen at Boston, seeing a ship come into the bay with English colors, soon came on board and asked for the captain. Ralph Goldsmith told them he was the commander. They asked him if he had any letters. He said yes. They asked if he would deliver them. He said no, not today. So they went ashore and reported that there was a ship full of Quakers and that Samuel Shattuck, who they knew was by their law to be put to death if he came again after banishment, was among them, but they knew not his errand nor his authority. So all were kept close that day, and none of the ship's company suffered to go on shore. Next morning, Samuel Shattuck, the king's deputy, and Ralph Goldsmith went on shore, and sending back to the ship the men that landed them, they too went through the town to Governor John Endicott's door and knocked. He sent out a man to know their business. They sent him word that their business was from the King of England, and that they would deliver their message to no one but the governor himself. Thereupon they were admitted, and the governor came to them, and having received the deputation and the mandamus, he put off his hat and looked upon them. Then going out, he bade the friends follow him. He went to the deputy governor, and after a short consultation came out to the friends and said, "We shall obey His Majesty's commands." After this, the master gave liberty to the passengers to come on shore, and presently the noise of the business flew about the town, and the friends of the town and the passengers of the ship met together to offer up their praises and thanksgiving to God, who had so wonderfully delivered them from the teeth of the devourer. While they were thus met, in came a poor friend, who, being sentenced by their bloody law to die, had lain some time in irons expecting execution. This added to their joy and caused them to lift up their hearts in high praise to God, who was worthy forever to have the praise, the glory, and the honor, for He only is able to deliver, to save, and support all that sincerely put their trust in Him. Here follows a copy of the mandamus. Charles R. Trusty and well-beloved, we greet you well. Having been informed that several of our subjects amongst you, called Quakers, have been and are imprisoned by you, whereof some have been executed, and others, as hath been represented unto us, are in danger to undergo the like, we have thought fit to signify our pleasure in that behalf for the future, and do hereby require that if there be any of those people called Quakers amongst you, now already condemned to suffer death or other corporal punishment, or that are imprisoned and obnoxious to the like condemnation, you are to forbear to proceed any further therein, but that you forthwith send the said persons, whether condemned or imprisoned, over into this our kingdom of England, together with the respective crimes or offenses laid to their charge, to the end that such course may be taken with them here as shall be agreeable to our laws and their demerits. And for so doing, these our letters shall be your sufficient warrant and discharge, given at our court at Whitehall the 9th day of September, 1661, in the 13th year of our reign. Subscribe to our trusty and well-beloved John Endicott, Esquire, and to all and every other, the governor or governors of our plantations of New England, and of all the colonies thereunto belonging, that now are or hereafter shall be, and to all and every minister and officers of our plantations and colonies whatsoever within the continent of New England, by His Majesty's command. Signed, William Morris. Footnote 169. Whittier has beautifully told the story of Samuel Shattuck's mission in his poem, The King's Missive. Longfellow has made the sufferings of the Quakers the subject of his dramatic poem, New England Tragedies. The story of Quaker suffering is told in George Bishop's New England Judged. The best modern book on the subject is Hollowell's Quaker Invasion of Massachusetts. Four friends were executed: William Robinson, Marmaduke Stevenson, William Leidra, and Mary Dyer. Sometime after this, several New England magistrates came over with one of their priests. We had several discourses with them concerning their murdering our friends, the servants of the Lord, but they were ashamed to stand to their bloody actions. On one of these occasions, I asked Simon Broadstreet, one of the New England magistrates, whether he had not had a hand in putting to death those four servants of God, whom they hung only for being Quakers, as they had nicknamed them. He confessed that he had. I then asked him and the rest of his associates that were present whether they would acknowledge themselves to be subject to the laws of England, and if they did, by what laws had they put our friends to death? They said they were subject to the laws of England and had put our friends to death by the same law that the Jesuits were put to death in England. I asked them then whether they believed those friends of ours whom they had put to death were Jesuits or Jesuistically affected. They said nay. Then said I, ye have murdered them. If ye have put them to death by the law by which the Jesuits are put to death here in England, and yet confess they were no Jesuits, by this it plainly appears ye have put them to death in your own wills without any law. Then Simon Broadstreet, finding himself and his company ensnared by their own words, asked if we came to catch them. I told them they had caught themselves and might justly be questioned for their lives. And if the father of William Robinson, one of them that were put to death, were in town, it was probable he would question them and bring their lives into jeopardy. Here they began to excuse themselves, saying, there is no persecution now amongst us. But next morning we had letters from New England telling us that our friends were persecuted there afresh. We went again and showed them our letters, which put them both to silence and to shame, and in great fear they seemed to be lest someone should call them to account and prosecute them for their lives. Especially was Simon Broadstreet fearful, for he had before so many witnesses confessed that he had a hand in putting our friends to death, that he could not get off from it, though he afterwards, through fear, shuffled and would have unsaid it again. After this, he and the rest soon returned to New England again. I went also to Governor Winthrop and discoursed with him on these matters. He assured me that he had no hand in putting our friends to death or in any way persecuting them, but was one of them that protested against it. About this time I lost a very good book, being taken in the printer's hands. It was a useful teaching work containing the signification and explanation of names, parables, types, and figures in the scriptures. They who took it were so affected with it that they were loath to destroy it. But thinking to make a great advantage of it, they would have let us have it again if we would have given them a great sum of money for it, which we were not free to do. Before this, while I was a prisoner in Lancaster Castle, the book called The Battle Door was published, which was written to show that in all languages, thou and thee is the proper and usual form of speech to a single person, and you to more than one. This was set forth in examples or instances taken from the scriptures and the books of teaching in about 30 languages. J. Stubbs and Benjamin Furley took great pains in compiling it, which I set them upon, and some things I added to it. Footnote 170. Here is the title page to this curious old book, which is now very rare and is much valued by collectors. A Battle Door for Teachers and Professors to Learn Singular and Plural, You to Many and Thou to One. Singular One, Thou. Plural, Many, You. Wherein is showed forth by grammar or scripture examples how several nations and people have made a distinction between singular and plural. And first, in the former part of this book, called the English Battle Door, may be seen how several people have spoken singular and plural. As the Apharsites, the Tarpolites, the Apharsites, the Archivites, the Babylonians, the Susanchites, the Dehavites, the Elamites, the Temanites, the Naomites, the Shuites, the Buzites, the Moabites, the Hivites, the Edomites, the Philistines, the Amalekites, the Sodomites, the Hittites, the Midianites, etc. Also in this book is set forth examples of the singular and plural about thou and you in several languages divided into distinct battle doors or forms or examples. English, Latin, Greek, Italian, Hebrew, Chaldic, Syriac, Arabic, Persiac, Ethiopic, Samaritan, Coptic, or Egyptic, Armenian, Saxon, Welsh, Mentz, Cornish, French, Spanish, Portugal, High Dutch, Low Dutch, Danish, Bohemian, Slavonian, and how emperors and others have used the singular word to one, and how the word you to one came first from the Pope. Likewise, some examples in the Polonian, Lithuanian, Irish, and East Indian, together with the singular and plural words thou and you in Swedish, Turkish, Muscovian, and Curlandian tongues. In the latter part of this book are contained several bad, unsavory words gathered first for certain school books, which have been taught boys in England, which is a rod and a whip to the schoolmasters in England and elsewhere who teach such books. George Fox, J. Stubbs, Benjamin Furley. London.